We have Alana Kingsley, who's on the far end, and she is a web librarian and assistant professor at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. When she's not taking care of her 31 sled dogs and one cat, some of her responsibilities include developing and maintaining the library website, electronic resources management, and bibliographic instruction. Beside her, we have Nick Roy, who is the digital strategies librarian at McMaster University. He heads up all of the library's digitization projects and manages our library's institutional repository. Next to Nick, we have Dave Mitchell, the only Canadian on the panel. And he is not a librarian, but rather an information technology specialist for the London Public Library. His specialties include, among other things, architectural design and maintenance of the library's website and intranet, custom software development and security privacy management. Beside Dave, we have Deborah Riley Huff, who is a web services librarian and assistant professor at the University of Mississippi. She has authored and presented on several aspects of web development for academic libraries, and she provides web authoring and And finally, we have Harish Nayak, who is a director of digital library initiatives for the River Campus Libraries, and is responsible for advanced development of various library systems, including several interfaces to the library catalog and the Fine Articles Metasearch tool at the University of Rochester. So I will turn it over to them. Do you want this to move forward now?
Hi, everyone. Can you hear me? Okay, I'm Alana Kingsley from University of Alaska Fairbanks, and I'll try not to drop my R's and G's, because, you know, we don't all talk like that out in Fairbanks. I just want to give you a brief format of the panel today. A lot of conferences you go to, I've seen lately Drupal, and I thought it would be a really great idea to have a bunch of people using Drupal in academic and public libraries so we can kind of tell you what we're doing. The downside of that is that we all have to talk really, really quickly. And so I will get started. I have two sites that I want to show. The first is the UAF movie browser. Yeah. No, click the slide. Yeah. And this was the first Drupal implementation that I worked on, and this was a collaborative project. This came about because we have a CRC Dynex system, and our patrons would come to the reference and circulation desk and say, "We want to browse movies. Can we come back to the circulation desk and look at the movie covers?" And we would say no, and they didn't like using our OPAC. It was really unfriendly. So, and they wanted to look at the movie covers. They really didn't care more about the description. They wanted to be able to browse. So what this implementation does, this is actually in Drupal 4.7. Oh, and let me just backtrack a second. For people who don't know what Drupal is, it's a content management system running off of PHP MySQL. So it's a dynamic driven database. So with this system, what it does is it pulls data, it screen scrapes the OPAC. Because it's a CRC product, we can't actually go into the database and pull data, so we have to have a separate instance or separate database. And then it goes out and it searches the Internet Movie Database and or Rotten Tomatoes, and you could see, I don't have a little laser pointer, but if you, do you have one?
I do not.
Oh. If you look on the screen, on the bottom one, there's IMDb and Rotten Tomatoes, where you can link into there and look at movie reviews. You can also then go into our catalog and check availability. It's pulling genres from the Internet Movie Database or Rotten Tomatoes, and it also gets the movie covers. And so hopefully you'll see an article about this in Code for Lib in December. We'll see if I can. We're porting this into Drupal 6.4, which is a really big jump to go from 4.7 to 6.4. One of the modules we're using doesn't exist anymore, so we're actually rewriting the whole entire thing. The next slide is the library website. So the whole website is database driven, and really the impetus for me doing this was kind of selfish. I'd get to my office every morning and I'd see these printouts of with little red circles saying, "Can you change this word?" And I thought, what a waste of my time to have to go in and edit someone, you know, change the name of a department when people can do it themselves. So I thought it would be really good to use a dynamic system to do that. And some interesting things about this, some modules that I'm using, the iRead banned books, that's actually an ad module or a campaign module, so that's interactive. It changes, kind of like a rotating ad. And Drupal is really good about, you can just put content wherever you want and display it to whomever you want. So I can say, well, only show this ad on the front page, but in the Alaska Digital Archives, let's show some archival pictures. So you can kind of personalize it like that. And I think I'm probably out of time with my intro, so I'll pass it on to the next person.
Hi, I am Deborah Riley Huff with the University of Mississippi Libraries, and I'm going to show you what we're using Drupal for at our site. We're currently using the content management system for two things, mainly the subject guides and that our librarians, our bibliographers put out, and we're also using it for government documents. For the subject guides, we used the content construction kit, which is one of the main killer modules really in Drupal, to create a unique content type for the subject guides. This is an example of like the drop-down menus and how they would look. So here, rather than have a very long list of all the different subject guides, we're able to break it into three main headings: humanities, sciences, and social sciences. And from there, you see that it integrates Web 2.0 things. There's a Amiibo chat widget in there. This is an example of like the art subject guide. I'm the bibliographer for art as well, so that's why my picture is up there. Each individual librarian is able to pick up unique RSS feeds that they want to display on their site as well. And then this is down toward the bottom of the same guide. And you can see that we've got a footer in place, and later we're going to talk a bit about theming, and I'll talk about how we match that up to the main part of our site. The University of Mississippi is in Oxford, and as probably many of you know, we hosted the first presidential debate. And the library's created a debate subject guide with a lot of different kinds of publications, article databases, past information, and we didn't really know how much it would get used. And in the days preceding the debate, the 3 days preceding the debate, we received over 5,000 unique views and tens of thousands of just hits and files served to the site. We have this set up on a WAMP server, Windows Apache, and with no caching enabled and no throttling, and the system performed very well. The campus web server went down, but we didn't, so. go ahead. And then we also are a state and federal depository, and we get very heavy use of our government documents site. And so this was a huge, I'm the only web developer person at the library. So this was a huge pain for me, updating this material all the time. So we moved it into Drupal, and now that librarian is able to go in. We have a WYSIWYG editor running, and she's able to maintain most of her own content. So we are also, our film librarian is going to have an associated blog with her. You can have a blog with it, with her subject guide. So that's what we're doing, and I'll pass it on.
Hello, my name is Harish Nayak. I'm the director of digital initiatives of the River Campus Libraries at the University of Rochester. I sort of inherited the position from Dave Lindahl and Nancy Foster just about a year ago. And what we've been doing mostly has always been just trying to forge ahead, even before Drupal. One of the major things we've carried forward is something of an article meta search that I remember presenting last year at an ex-Libris conference. Going forward with Drupal, we just identified that it's been quite a while, something on the order of 4 years since we've redesigned our website from scratch. We had been using closed source software to do so. So in order to make things a little bit, to just facilitate more collaboration with other institutions, and then also just open things up a little bit to the rest of the campus and try to work better with our university IT and our faculty, we saw it as an opportunity to move towards open source platforms. So we identified Drupal and a few other things like Plone. And at almost the exact same time as I was picking up this position, Dave and Nancy were basically active and awarded grant funding to start building a next-gen catalog called XC, or the Extensible Catalog. They've chosen the Drupal platform and were strongly encouraging me to do the same. And basically through a null hypothesis kind of process, we basically stuck with that platform. Going forward, we identified a lot of the same kinds of needs as the rest of the panel in terms of subject guides and things like that and building them. What I'm going to focus on today is how we got theming to work a little bit to our liking, and particularly how we got one need that I guess we identified as useful, improving the stickiness of our website by offering customization to our users so they don't have to see what they don't want to. Next slide real quick. And I'll be just kind of going, just showing a few examples from our current alpha.
Okay, I'm Dave Mitchell. I'm, as I mentioned, I'm the only Canadian here, so also the only public library on the panel. So our needs were maybe a little different in choosing Drupal than maybe some of the other academic libraries. One of the primary concerns was actually cost. We didn't have the resources to implement initially what was going to be an intranet. I'm not going to touch too much on that because it's actually quite dated now. We've been using it for about 3 years and hasn't been touched since. It keeps ticking, but we're moving now on to revamping that up to the current version of Drupal. And what I'll primarily be showing, though, today is how we chose Drupal for our public library website and how we learned lessons from the previous version to the current version in not going overboard on customization and trying to use the existing infrastructure in Drupal so that you've got the scalability when you you go between upgrades and new versions. I think I'll probably save slides till later on because the website's going to look the same in those slides as they do at the beginning, but I don't think I have too much to add.
I'm Nick. Oops. Does that work? I'm Nick from McMaster. My Drupal setup is a little bit different than the rest of my colleagues. It's younger like I am. And it isn't necessarily a library site like the rest of them are. It's our library's digital collections portal. When I started at McMaster, we didn't really have an infrastructure for digital collections management. And the current digitization project, or at the time, was the Peace and War collection. And it was maintained with a FileMaker database with a ODBC connector to a web interface, which was pretty scary. And so being the open source evangelist that I can be at times, I chose to forego the route of commercial solutions, such as Content DM. No offense to OCLC, Luna, and DLXS. But I needed something I could smash and modify, and I wasn't sold on any one product set of features. But Drupal out of the box isn't really a digital collections content management system, but at the heart, things are there. But really all I needed was Dublin Core Fields, and I took advantage of CCK, the custom content kick, and I needed OAI compliance, so I'll talk more about that later, how I customized that. So with the help of a couple of developers, Ryan Barrett and Debbie Lawler, without whose hard work this project would be nowhere near it is now, we've modified Drupal into a digital collections management system, which that's the portal for our collections. And next one. That's the Peace and War website.
Process. So why did UAF chose to go with Drupal? I looked at a bunch of content management systems. I did look at Plone, which I think Plone was running on Python. Yeah, and I didn't know Python, so I was like, that's out. You know, I knew PHP. I looked at Joomla and then Drupal, and for me, and then Mambo, which I think Mambo and Joomla combined. But Drupal was just so easy out of the box. I mean, I don't consider myself a programmer. I can, you know, hack around with PHP and get results that I want, but I'm not a formal programmer. So for me, setting up Drupal was really easy. I knew how to create a MySQL database. I knew the basics of PHP. The installation went so smoothly, I didn't really need to do any tweaking, and that's why I chose Drupal. And also, there's so much user support. There's a big Drupal community out there, and there's modules coming all the time. Now, we'll talk about having to be careful about which modules you select, because some of them come and go really quickly, and they don't get supported, and some of them don't port over to a new system. But for the most part, the support, the community, the Drupal community was great. Anytime you had a question, you can answer. You can also answer questions for people. The process at UAF, it was actually a long process. It took around 2 years to implement. I was the only person working on it at the time. Part of the problem getting it up and running was political. At UAF, our IT department, not the library IT department, we have a new department now, but previous to that, the university department wouldn't allow PHP and MySQL. So, and that's why my other site is not on a UAF server. I actually had to get a pirate server where I can run PHP and MySQL. And to this day, still, the university does not support PHP and MySQL, but I was able to get my own IT department and get my own servers that we can run this stuff on. So after I chose Drupal, there was the CMS installation, went really smoothly. And then the next big thing was content analysis for me. I come from IBM and Cisco, where we did a lot of documentation, and we had meeting after meeting of content analysis, of looking at web pages and deciding, categorizing it. And, you know, I didn't really understand at the time when I was at those corporations why we need to do this. I just wanted to go ahead and build. But I think taking some preliminary analysis of what the content types are is important, because later on you're going to match a user role to a content type. And then that person within that role will have access. So my site is built where certain people can edit certain content based on a content type. Then moving the content from our static HTML page into Drupal, that was a manual process. There's probably some programmers out there who could port it in, but I actually had to go look through the content. And I did a lot of editing as well. I think I have this in another slide later on, but the static site was very long and lengthy, and a lot of times people want to just, you know, write policy on there, and the users don't want to look at policy. So the new site, I did try to keep things quite short. One of the things I'm finding, though, with my content contributors is that they often still want to write in lengthy things, so I kind of act as the web editor and cut that out, which sometimes people don't like. But I find it's the librarians who want to be more chatty. And then what I do is I look at modules. You know, this is kind of a process that's ongoing, so I'll see a need, and then I'll look and see if there's a module out there. I have a test server. I keep on testing new modules, and I probably have tested many modules, and a lot of them don't make the cut for what I need. And since I'm not a programmer, if it doesn't make the cut, I need to find out a different solution of what I can do. I often am in the forums asking if, you know, can you make this module fit to my needs? And sometimes I hear yes, sometimes people say no, you know, leave me alone, I'm not going to support this module anymore. And then the training for the content providers was the last thing. I just have two rules, which is keep it short and don't cut and paste from Word. I use, which is a hard thing to get across. People still do it. I use TinyMCE, which is a editor. I did look at different editors around there. I think there was FCK editor, and there's a whole bunch of other ones. But with many of the editors, and this is a known problem, is that if you have PHP code somewhere in the page, it messes up the PHP code once you save it. So TinyMCE was probably the most harmless one, and I still have some problems. But what I've done is anything that's PHP-based, I don't let people edit. The other training part, how many people are here familiar with Drupal? Just kind of curious. Okay, good. one of the problems I've had is explaining what a view is. So a view pulls data. You can have different kind of data, and the view pulls it onto one page. But in Drupal, I don't know if they changed this in 6.4, in Drupal 5.7 and Drupal 5 and 4, there's on the edit field, there's a view, as in view what the page looks like, and then the edit button. And so a lot of times people will say, well, can I edit this content? And I have to show them how. I try to explain to them, you can't edit it because it's a view. And it's just the terminology. They don't really understand what a view is. They think they see view on the page and say, well, I'm viewing the page. So that's the one problem I have, is that I do have content being pulled that people can't edit what they see on the page, although they can edit the individual content snippet. I think Harish is next. Oh, no, I have more. Okay, so here are my content types. I have a bunch of content types, and this is what I was talking about a little before, earlier before. I think it was important for me to create these different content types, and if I just have the first example. The ones that are view-based would be like the APR collections and exhibits, so someone can come in and just put a particular information about a collection in, and then we're not live here, so I can't show you what it looks like, but then the view page pulls all of that data in. If you can go to the next one, thanks. Here's the internal view of a content type. You have a lot of, you could create any kind of content that you want. A lot of my content types are kind of short. The base content, I believe, is a story and a page, so I just kind of build upon that. I also use a taxonomy feature, and that's another reason why I selected Drupal, because they have a really awesome taxonomy module, and they have around like 100 different taxonomy modules. I create the site index, which I really need to work on, but the site index is built on tagging and the taxonomy module. One of the things that I was going to do as an experiment, I'm an indexer, like a back-of-the-book indexer, and so I want to look at how users tag content in index creation. And so right now I've got the content contributors, when they enter content, they can enter their own tags, and I have been coming up with funny things, and I end up having to edit the index, because the site index, because what they put in really doesn't make sense. And these and these are librarians putting content, you know, tagging their content, and they may tag content that just isn't appropriate. And again, it's been an interesting process. You can go to the next one. Okay, here are my UAF roles, which the content types are based off of. What I did, and this is a kind of a lessons learned type of thing, is I made my roles based on department, and I found out, I was able to alter this later on, but I figured there was only going to be one or two content contributors in each department, so anyone, if there's seven people in a department, they can all edit each other's content. And that's kind of working out. There are some people who would rather have content be edited by one person, and I can control that as well. So this is my choice, and I'd be interested in hearing your guys' way of how you created roles. And okay, now we're on to Harish.
Okay. I think Lana touched on a lot of the things from certainly an implementation standpoint. I just wanted to, I guess, sort of add to it and discuss a little bit more about what goes on outside of the implementation itself. I guess, stealing from Ilana's technique, how many of you are familiar with the term user-centered design? Okay, decent amount. Basically, what we used was a process that was designed primarily to facilitate buy-in from our own staff, but then also validate our assumptions and our feelings about the community that used the library website. A couple more things. I guess every environment's going to be different when taking on a project like this. I guess in contrast to Fairbanks, University of Rochester is something of a confederate web environment. Everyone's been always about building their own, whether it's the physics department or a library or university IT itself has always been just trying to corral them together or say, oh, there's a security issue here or there, the other thing. So with our environment, we're concerned with making sure that we weren't the weakest link. And you might face this, but it's something of an unfounded impression that there are holes or there's some security issues with Drupal, but I think the same people are saying the same thing about PHP or dynamic web programming as a whole, so it's not necessarily something to contend with seriously, but I've found some prejudice about that and moving forward. We were primarily in an environment using ColdFusion. People were going into Dreamweaver and just sort of with no training wheels doing their own web development, and I'm specifically talking about people like subject librarians or those in charge of department pages. And oftentimes they fell into certain traps or holes. And my group, while it's primarily more like an R&D kind of thing, ended up being very much a web services or support operation. So in the interest of trying to not let people get stuck in those holes, we looked towards things like WYSIWYG editors and things like that. But we knew we didn't have the whole picture. So we have had a process in place for a few years that breaks things up, just going kind of clockwise around, starting with user research. Nancy Foster is the staff anthropologist at the University of Rochester River Campus Libraries, and she basically headed an effort that did an ethnographic study on undergraduate student. She's been doing a graduate student study, faculty study, giving us a lot of information about what all these different parties do in their entire day. What do they care about? Irrespective of technology, and so we were able to pull a lot from that, and some other projects were able to pull information as well, including the building of a new study space. So clockwise around, we had a technology group that basically was really making sure that everybody else knew what was out there. Oftentimes in trying to fledge forward with a design or forge forward with a content idea, a lot of times librarians involved in this process would just constantly want to ask, well, can we do that? Is that possible? Is that easy? Is that hard? So the point of that group was mainly to try to work towards educating everybody in the process about what's possible, what's easy. It's particularly from the end of Drupal itself. So giving demos on TinyMC or showing what a content type means or what a view is and how hard or easy it is to make helped a lot in terms of improving people's confidence in us moving platforms. Down the way from technology, usability is probably the one thing that validates our entire, it's sort of the checkpoint to make sure that we're actually on the right track. Doing different kinds of studies that are aligned by, I think Jacob Nielsen is sort of one of those guys out there that tells you a lot about how to conduct this kind of work. It's just sort of testing, it's not software testing, it's really just validating designs themselves. Using implementations is usually the easiest way to do it because you can see all the different dimensions. Implementation, I'll get into that in a few moments, but that's obviously a part of this, and design really is our driver. It's where our requirements come from. Maybe not so much stuff like content analysis, but it does necessarily, our graphic designer tends to needs to know more and more about Drupal so he knows what assumptions he can make. So that's a little bit about the processes outside. These all interconnect, and I don't mean to scare anyone away from a crazy process, but it's not that crazy. This is meant to reflect iterations between different groups that are going to worry about different stuff as often, and they would meet and produce work products as often as they need to in order to inform everybody. Like, if you can think about it clockwise, user research gets the ball rolling and gets everyone clamoring away over whatever the findings are. Oh, faculty want this? Really? Are you kidding? Or something like that would be a discussion that would be had. And the central piece, this content group I didn't talk about previously, this is a bunch of core, a group of department heads, subject librarians, people from our access services, that would be like interlibrary loan or reserves or people like that. Basically a cross-section of our library staff that particularly at a higher level so that that sort of knows what we're doing and gets a sense of where we're headed and offers their input. In that way, we can take certain technical leaps and kind of have the buy-in from all angles of the staff itself. And just really kind of going around in that clockwise way, you can see how all these things, it's not really, the starting point might be the user research, but after that, it's really just these different groups kind of interacting. The point is to keep things fluid, not allow anyone to be waiting. And it sort of puts a stress on a great deal of communication. Nancy Foster from our libraries has put out an article on Code4Lib about the user research done for this project and a little bit about where we're headed and how we kind of prioritize what we wanted to actually produce in the new website. here I'm just kind of showing how it could get more complicated if you want it to be, but I guess we'll just skip that. Theming?
Yeah. Am I first on the theming one?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. We're going to talk to you a little bit about theming. Theming is actually, you know, what would be your style of the site. Drupal, when it comes out of the box, has, I think, four or five themes that you can pick from. And they kind of have the standard blue look. The WordPress is a little bit similar. This is an unmodified Garland theme, which is one of the ones that comes out of the box. And this one was new in version 5, and people were kind of excited about some of the things that you can do. There's like a dial thing that you can change the color and stuff like that. Theming is one of the more important things that you have to pay attention to when you upgrade different versions and when you add different modules on, because themes break very easily. And, you know, you upgrade modules a lot. Security updates come out, and so you're upgrading from, like, version 5.5 to 5.6, 5.7. You might be doing that, like, every month. And a lot of us don't have time to mess around with things breaking. So the process of choosing themes and modules that are supported well, that you understand thoroughly, and the way that you work with them is I just can't stress the importance enough. Otherwise, you're just setting yourself up for a nightmare. Part of the way that Drupal works is it's built around a core, and then you've got the themes that come with it are actually kind of part of that core. And then you can choose to download also third-party modules and third-party themes and build your own themes. We chose to heavily modify a Garland theme because the basic theme is supported out of the box, but yet it wasn't what I wanted it to look like in the end. It's got to kind of match up somewhat to our website. So part of that process is, in modifying this, is that you copy the entire theme over into Drupal. Has an area called Sites, and that's a part within your platform that's where you make all your modifications. And then so you rebuild that theme in there. It's got a whole different name. You hook it in, you enable it, and that way you're never touching the core. And that way, if you've got a problem later, you're working within your own thing. You can turn it off, fix it, and stuff like that, and your core isn't broken, and none of your content is broken. So this is an unmodified Garland theme, and you can go to the next one. This was a challenge. This was our library website as it currently looks, and so we didn't have time to do a whole website rebuild when we decided to go with Drupal. So the challenge was to come up with something that looked pretty similar, and that's why I went ahead and worked with Garland. Now, there are other options, and one of the third-party modules is called Zen, and a third-party theme, and that one is very stripped-down CSS-based and is a lot easier to just theme out. Theming one of the included themes is very difficult to do, but in our case, it gave us more of a feel that matched our site. We can go to the next one. So you can see this is not exactly the same. You can't make it look exactly the same, but you can get there. We have drop-down menus on the main site, so we have drop-down menus here. And when I showed you that last one, the bottom of it, that footer at the bottom is a mirror of the footer that's on our homepage. So it looks a little bit different, but the same navigation and content is all there. This is all done through CSS modifications. And let me see here. There's a lot of good tutorials on the site for retheming Garland if you want to do that. And when we're ready to go to our next iteration of our homepage and make some changes there, what I will do is I'll probably go with Zen and then you know, because then one didn't exist before the other. Now that they both exist at the same time, I'll be able to work with them both at the same time and get a look that that's a little better for us. And part of the, some of the things that we had to use to make this work just the way we wanted was we relied really heavily on the content construction kit that Ilana talked about, and nice menus are the only way to get your drop-down menus in a Garland theme. So there's a book out, Pro Drupal Development, by Matt Westgate, and I would, if you're going to work in Drupal, that's a really great book that, that'll help you out. Let me see. Yeah, I think that's what I've got for things.
Guess so, yeah. I'm just going to get a little bit into the Zen theme itself and some other things. At the U of R, we've actually decided to go in that route primarily because having discovered it, it does make things a lot easier, especially from the programmer's point of view, if you're comfortable with cascading style sheets. Let me just ask real quick, have any of you ever heard of Firebug? It's an add-on to Firefox. It's a lifesaver. It really is. What it does, I mean, you can literally just have Firefox open on one end, have your Drupal instance open on the other side, or particularly the style sheet within a portion of Zen. I'm going to get into this. Sub-themes really is what I'm talking about. And just test things out and throw in the change. And it, there really isn't anything else to the theme. So literally all you're doing really is just overlaying whatever you want and just using the simple cascading model through what the Zen theme calls its sub-themes. So Zen really is meant to just be that starter kit. Zen's really helpful in the sense that it kind of thinks it sort of is a manifestation of everything you should be thinking about. Style for the layout, style for how should it print, and which I'm going to be finding very necessary, especially if I'm going to try out the whole iGoogle thing. And then sub-themes themselves, which not only allow you to basically override what comes with the theme itself and the package as a whole, but also would allow you to almost skin different parts of your site differently based on variables of your choosing. So it's a lot easier, like Deborah was mentioning, it's a lot easier for a CSS developer to kind of get into Zen. Things are laid out in something of a very easy to access level of classes and IDs. They all kind of make sense, so to speak, if you understand what's going on the Drupal end, that this is a node such and such, and this is for the type, and this is for the footer. All that kind of layout is kind of trying to hint you along. It's not some terms that don't make any sense if they're coming from somebody else's site, let's say. And like I was saying, all the class names in the CSS styles are very mindful in that way. So some of the examples of things that would be possible with sub-theming particularly is having different, well, you can have different items have different colors for an authenticated user as opposed to someone who isn't, or change the entire layout of the page just based on what page it is, and have those kinds of exceptions very easily. And in this way, you wouldn't actually have to have some really great scheme for how you want to manifest your design. You can rely a great deal, like many things in Drupal, on the work of others. And that's basically what I wanted to get into about Zen. Sub-themes themselves and overriding, I think I mentioned that already. The other piece of that's going to be very, I guess, conducive to the kind of site that we want to build at the University of Rochester is facilitating customization. And the way we're doing that is with a module that's not exactly that well-known, but it's pretty solid. It's called My Site, and it is what you think it is. Basically is the wannabe, how do you build an iGoogle, a Yahoo, any of those kinds of things? How do you have those kinds of widgets just kind of show up with content that you intend in locations, allow the user to make some changes to how it looks, and also where it is on the page? That whole drag and drop capability is kind of part of this. There is a similar module called Panels that has a little bit more favor, a little bit more attention in the Drupal community, but it kind of stops at the door of the administrator, allowing them to, in a very WYSIWYG kind of way, decide how the page is going to be laid out. What My Site does is thrust it forward down to the user. Now, that obviously leaves your own development group to be a little bit needing to be a little bit more responsible, a little bit more careful in the ways of security, and you're definitely egging for a lot more traffic on your website architecture. So you do need to be prepared for that. but obviously since it's in JavaScript, it does also rely on the user as well to kind of balance out the those kinds of features. So we wanted to create a personalized page that contains the content from throughout the site. We did not want people to have to go to different pages. We knew that would kind of, that's already been turning people off from our current site, having to go through many different mouse clicks. That's obviously always known to be a not so good thing. Pulling things from feeds and other places outside of our site, especially from other parts of the university, in order to make the library website something of a portal, but I know we already have one where I think we're using Blackboard for a lot of stuff, but there's still a way for the refining to kind of make the library relevant, especially from the academic point of view, not necessarily from the social point of view. What's nice about my site and panels, really, is that they do fully integrate into Drupal content and all those types. So you can kind of really take advantage of things like all the work you would be doing, and Ilana's doing this, and I know all of us are doing this to some degree, breaking down content types based on, you know, what kind of information you want, so that it's, it becomes easier. You can just look at titles or names of content types and know that's the kind of material you're intending for to show up in a particular, I guess what we've decided to call widget, although there's a million terms for what do you call that little section of a page that's got a box that looks like a window. I think Google calls them gadgets. It doesn't really matter what you call them. And the drag and drop and sorting content of users' pages is something else that we wanted to achieve. All this leads to basically an increased stickiness on the library website, and that's why we focused on it so much. So again, I'll just show the unmodified Zen theme and the unmodified Garland theme. Garland's a little bit more to it, but the point is Zen is really not meant to be the end-all, be-all. You're meant to really dive in there, so it's facilitating that. Here is the My Site module loaded into an instance of Drupal that's using the unmodified Zen theme. You can see these boxes. You can see that in the lower right-hand corner of the top box. Basically what that is, one wide box and two smaller boxes below. You can actually choose a couple different layouts that are part of the module itself. This is something that's shared by panels and my site, is sort of, well, I don't want to have to deal with all writing all those tables or writing all that CSS for that stuff. Just show me some sort of a, I'll just choose a radio button for how I want the page to be generally laid out, whether it's three columns or something different. So in this case, it's one large header and two columns, with the ability to, and I don't have a live piece either, but with the ability to collapse those boxes, make them disappear altogether for the session that you're in right now, that temporary user session that really is a misnomer in HTTP, but at least you can kind of clear up the screen if you're trying to focus on one portion of the screen or just something really noisy, you can turn it off, so to speak. And, in this case, this is basically throwing in a modified Zen and modified My Site, not so much the My Site part, but certainly Zen. And this is basically a screenshot of our current university library website, the alpha, that we're having a lot of staff testing on, a lot of user usability testing on, and basically trying to get the kinks worked out with things like TinyMC and getting, well, I don't think in Drupal 5 the word issue is always a problem. It's certainly a problem when you start getting into the real crazy features of Word, but if you just got plain text or rich text, I think it still takes it, okay? It's sort of dicey. But for the most part, the key is allowing library staff to not have to be an expert at HTML and style sheets and whatever dynamic language you're intending for the back end of your website. With this, basically, I just meant to show that... basically, on the right hand side of those boxes in that screenshot, you have things like news and library hours. They're collapsed so you can look at some other things. So we have one thing we're playing around with is just one of those Amazon style flash carousels of new titles. So that's what you're seeing at the kind of the bottom right hand side of that screen. And switching your attention up to the top left, that's sort of that area, that search library resources, meant to be our search box for all the things that we have identified as what people are looking for. And in usability testing, we've seen, you know, basically you do go up to the top left, as long as there's nothing really crazy or compelling anywhere else on the screen, it's above the fold, all those kinds of things kind of direct our attention towards trying to put what people really care about in that section of the page. So that's sort of, you can ignore the all there. That's kind of a placeholder for XC, but having a look into our OPAC, the Voyager OPAC, and our fine articles. I have our fine articles is a meta search tool using MetaLib X server. I have the tab activated there with some of the clusters that we have available from the front end. If you're just kind of looking for some article and something, the databases, e-journals, all those kinds of things that we know people have been using frequently on our own website. Okay. And moving over to modules. Sorry.
Should we just kind of skip this?
Yeah, just really quickly, these are our what we came up with as the must-have modules that that you really should get. Very quick slide.
So from an architectural perspective, actually, I guess there may have been a slide before this. We're just moving into customization now, basically where out of the box, Drupal didn't do what we wanted it to do. And when I started with Drupal in 2004 working on an intranet site, the number of modules actually was so small that there wasn't even a directory structure for organizing them. And now there's hundreds of them. So at that time, I had to learn to build things for myself if I wanted them. And the great thing about Drupal being open is that the engine was right there for me to go in and do whatever I wanted. So right now, we're just looking. I'm probably going to go through this quickly. One of the custom modules that I built was a block feature in Drupal 5, and on the right-hand side there's the new items, and it's using it's taking RSS feeds that we're generating out of our catalog, creating a new items rotisserie using AJAX so that it fits our accessibility standards, and those items now are tagged with the taxonomy so that they appear on relevant pages. So if you've got a new item list for government materials, that'll appear on any page that's also related to the government type of content. We'll pop to the next slide. And we had mentioned about some of the issues with theming. So the sort of ugly box, and this is something that's in testing right now, so I haven't actually implemented on our live site, but in the upper right corner there is a modified version of a shout box, which is an existing module. What I wanted to do with this module is actually rip it apart, like Nick. I like to blow things up. And I wanted to take the fact that I could tie the taxonomy for this block to all the pages that are related to it. So you could basically have a conversation that could exist throughout all the related content on your website. So if we pop to the next page, we'll see that the same conversation goes to another page that's related to government content. The difference between this and having normal comments on a page was that they were taken out of the context and kept together. So if someone made some profound statement on one particular page, they didn't have to find that one particular page to find the useful information. You just had to find the general area based upon the taxonomy. And as this module goes public, because it's using a different authentication model than we're using elsewhere, we want to make sure we go into peer moderation. So if someone's posting something inappropriate, then it gets flagged, and then our staff will moderate it. Now we'll pop on to the next page. And one of the things that really excited me about using Drupal was its power and its taxonomy. And We, being a public site, we have to it cater to different age groups. So we've got our adult or general website, the kids-centric website, and then a teen-centric website as well. Initially, we thought, well, we would create three different websites, and they'd each have their own themes. And the problem we ran into is we didn't want to have to have a search engine that would crawl across them and bring them all together into a homebrewed federated search. And we wanted people to be able to go in and out transparently between these sites. And I guess the last feature would be some of the privacy concerns that were relevant to those different categorizations of users. So there's a module that was out there called Taxonomy Theme, and what it allowed us to do when we create any page was we would say, is this a adult, teen, or child based page? And if you pop to the next, oops, that one's stuck in there in the wrong place. Next one. So there's an example of our kids' website, and the next one will show the teen. So it's actually, the content is all the same, taking advantage of the theming engine, and just by changing that one tag describing the content, it's flipping the theme on the fly, which allowed us to use just a single website. We'll move on to the next slide. The other thing we wanted to do was use the taxonomy to really drive navigation features within the website so we could be pulling related content. So the entire site map was driven by a taxonomy. So when you're creating a page, you choose where in the site map this page would fall. And we go to the next page. And that menu structure then would actually drive, that classification structure would drive the menus that are on the website. But we also use those menus outside of the library website into the catalog, into our third-party reservation system for booking computers. The key was we wanted the look and feel to be consistent across all of our web presence. So we continue on. And again, all the blocks, all the RSS feeds, all the blogs are all classified by where they should be in the in that taxonomy, and all the pieces will draw together and provide a more robust experience for the user that's coming through. And I think I'll Nick.
Okay. You can skip to me. I'll kind of go through this quick because we're pressed on time. I touched on it earlier. I mean, essentially, if I have a digital collection site, it needs to be harvestable. And that didn't work out of the box. They had an OAI module for the bibliographic module, and I wasn't going to use that. So what I did is stripped it apart. It had a ton of joins in it, and to make it work with CCK, it's hard-coded to my site right now because I haven't had time to generalize it. I had to modify all the SQL queries because they were just completely inefficient. And then once I did that, I had to do a bunch of other tweaking to get it past the OAI testing, which then I registered with Oyster and Illinois Urbana-Champaign. And then, to do that, it worked with Post, but it didn't work with Git. And then when our Ontario harvested it last week, we noticed that the tokens weren't working right and the list records from a particular set weren't working right, and those were just bad SQL queries that I had to go back and modify. So it's been harvested by Knowledge Ontario, Oyster, and Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and then another module I customized. There's an automatic node titles module, which is great for if you're just doing for digital collection records. It'll combine CCAK fields and automatically generate a title for that node. The problem is if you have a bunch of nodes in there already, it doesn't go back and rename all the old ones. And so I noticed if you opened up a node in the edit view and just hit submit, it would rename the title. So then I just wrote a PHP script that essentially opens up all the nodes of a particular content type that are supposed to have this renaming feature, and then save it. So it's just a big, long SQL query in PHP. Next one. And then these next two were just for development. So when we're doing a bunch of batch node imports and we're trying to see how things work, the caching modules are really good, but at times they don't show the content right away. So I created a clear cache module, which is just essentially a MySQL stored procedure that truncates any selected cache tables, and we use that in development. And same thing with the delete orphans. So like if we messed up a node import and you try to delete all the nodes, it leaves, well, if you have it tied in with categories and containers, so nodes will go under like in a hierarchy in a collection if they fit under a particular theme or case study. If you deleted all those nodes, they left little orphans all over the place. So essentially what this is another MySQL stored procedure that deletes all the records from all the connected tables. And the last one was one Ryan did, so I'm just going to touch on it. With the Peace and War website, we wanted in our case studies to have a timeline so it'd be interactive and the user can see where all the records lie on a timeline for a particular case study. And to do this, when I started, the dates were being entered in like any and every format. So we had to write a bunch of regular expressions to correct the dates. And we used the current MIT simile timeline. So we had to write scripts to control the scale and the population bands of it, and change the pop-up box so it modified it to open like a quick AJAX preview of the node, which then in turn lets you go to the node. And we changed it to work. We had to change the JSON output to work with the dates that we use with the regular expressions. And this is just a screenshot of the timeline. So you can drag the bottom bar and the upper bar separately. And then the little timeline tab on the left, you can click that and it hides it back down at the bottom of the page. Jump to lessons learned, or
yeah, we probably don't have time. Yeah. So if we could take like one or two questions, if anyone has any. Yeah, I think the guy in the back. Yeah.